Hello and welcome to the Political Punch podcast. I'm Jake Tapper in Washington, D.C., and joining us today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch, who's just written a new book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, and we'll explain in a second just what this book is. But first of all, Taylor Branch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jake. Nice to be here.
So my understanding is that from 93 until the end of the Clinton presidency, you had 79 long discussions with President Clinton that you tape recorded, but you don't have the tapes. He does. But you would take assiduous notes afterwards in your tape recorder about everything that was said. And that's what this book comes from.
That's right. It's a memoir of what it's like to compile a secret oral history with the sitting president. The tape recording were my tape machines that I would bring into the White House up into the residence almost always late at night. I had two dictaphones because I was always worried that one of them would malfunction. So we made two sets of tapes that, on my advice, he kept personally. He didn't give them to an aide. He was petrified that the aides would leak word that this was happening. So it was pretty private. In the second term, he showed me where he had been hiding them so that I could put the tapes away while he went off to attend to other things. He didn't want to wait for me to rewind them. By the second term, when we had kept it secret for 5 years, he showed me he'd been hiding them in his socks drawer up in the closet near the bedroom. And I would, when I left the White House, pop another tape into one of my two recorders, and all the way driving home to Baltimore, dictate everything I could remember about what happened, and that's the basis for this memoir.
Now, did you take notes while you were talking to him, or you tried to make it as conversational as possible, and so note-taking would have been an obstruction to that process?
I didn't take very many notes. I wrote down things that I checked off the topics that we'd covered, and I wrote down the proper names that he was always popping off with, because he was talking to me in political shorthand about everything under the sun, from peace negotiations to tax bills to Chelsea's homework. I took some minimal notes, but you'd be surprised if you're talking to a president driving home, even at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. I would dictate for a couple of hours things that I could remember, topics that he covered and things that were surprising that he said.
But the book does not have as many quotes, certainly, as you would have been able to contribute to the book had you had the tapes.
No, I think the book, the quotes are more or less as if I had done an interview, like I've done a lot of interviews, were writing an article, when he used a striking enough phrase that I had confidence that in those exact words I would use them. Otherwise, I would paraphrase.
Now, have you heard from the former president about the book since it's come out? I know that you sent him a copy, and he asked you to not include some things, is my understanding. But have you heard from him since?
Well, I heard from him a bunch of times since. I actually took him a copy of the book, of the proofs, up in Chappaqua. But it was headed to the press, and it was last minute, and I told him I couldn't make any cosmetic changes. He did actually find a couple of errors that at the last minute I did in the production office change, but they were on the order of I referred to Jiang Zemin of China as the premier of president. He said the title had been changed after Deng Xiaoping to president. So he found a few things like that. But he was worried mostly about the personal nature of the book, that there was more about it in the book about Chelsea and Hillary than he expected. And he said, look, anything's fair for me. I've been through this. I agree to do this, but I'm not sure they did not. He was afraid that things about them would be distorted.
That's interesting. I didn't see much in there that would be distortable about Chelsea or Hillary. It seemed mainly to be there was an interesting moment where you you help Chelsea with her homework in the book about Frankenstein.
Well, no, there's a lot more than that. I mean, Hillary comes in and runs through a dream that she's had about Henry Kissinger. Hillary comes in, cusses and yells, talks about all kinds of things about.
I just meant Chelsea. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, about Chelsea. Well, there's a little.
There was
her
not wanting to be seen with him at Stanford. I guess
her not wanting to be seen with him at Stanford. Her her, he said that when she quit ballet, that he had always admired her because she pursued ballet for 12 years, even though she was 4 inches taller and 20 pounds heavier than any of the other ballet people in her class. And he said he admired her for that because she pursued it out of sheer love, even though she was more gifted naturally for other things, and that he had never done anything like that. He knew he was gifted in politics and didn't want to pursue things where he would eventually be told he was out of his league. And I left that story in there because I thought it was accurate and about both of them. But he said you'd be surprised how many people are so malicious that they would distort that and say that he had attacked his own daughter's body type.
I see what you're saying. So, yeah, I just didn't read it that way.
Yeah,
but okay,
there are lots of things like that. But I think a fair-minded reader wouldn't do that. But he was worried about distortion.
Certainly the Hillary chapters, the Hillary sections there are revealing, but I also think of Senator, or should I say Secretary Clinton, as somebody who's in the public light. Although I guess you're right, she did not agree to this, but did she not know that you guys were doing this project from 93
on? Oh, no, she knew about it. In fact, she would sit in on it, yeah. She was one of the few people who knew about it, she and Nancy Hernreich and a couple of Nancy's assistants, but that was just about it, and I'm proud we brought it off to keep it secret, but the whole interest in keeping it secret was to make it public later. That we knew that if it got revealed that he had secret tapes, that there'd be a cry to get at them. And
right.
There's already some bloggers are saying that these tapes should have been turned over to Kenneth Starr and that there should be a criminal investigation and that sort of thing. I don't think that'll go anywhere, but we knew it would be controversial in the moment.
So what has he said to you since the book came out?
I haven't talked to him since the book came out, since it was published. That's been less than a month. But I had about four conversations on the phone about it. It was funny. He said, you know, there's some things you might want to revise in future editions and other things where he thought I could go stronger. And he was trying to figure out how people would look at it, but mostly he was worried about his family.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. I haven't seen much in the reviews or in any of the writings about it that really seized upon the family stuff at all. The stuff that the history and the newsmaking is what's struck me the most. We can get into some of that if you want. I mean, as long as we're talking about the personal stuff, there really isn't a huge section, and I guess it's because you didn't do it during a lot of the Lewinsky era during the Kenneth Starr episode. But that's a long episode, but during some of those months, you didn't have your sessions.
No, actually the peak of the Lewinsky, mortification for him, began with his confession in August, which was always a skimpy time for our tapes because he would go on vacation, through the end of August. And then when he got back, the Congress would come back from that recess and he would have a huge backlog. So September was a bad month. And so he confessed to Lewinsky in August, then went on that horrible vacation where Hillary wouldn't even walk beside him when he was sleeping on the sofa. And we didn't have a session until October, right before the 98 elections, and then he was impeached. And by the time we resumed our sessions, he and Hillary were on... had reconciled to the degree that she came into several of the sessions and was a fiercer defender of his about impeachment than he was, even on an impeachment that grew out of a scalding humiliation for her. So they kind of restored their at least some sort of even keel in their I can only say communion. The way they talk to one another is always pretty warm and very collegial. A lot about politics and a lot about humor and a lot about their family.
What when he says to you, explaining what happened with Lewinsky, the fact that he even engaged in that relationship with that very young woman, and he says he just cracked. He says it almost like the language that he uses in the book, I cracked, I just cracked. It's almost like an alcoholic explaining why he had a drink after so many years. That's what it struck me as. What did you take that remark as?
Well, he paired it with another statement, which was that it was self-pity, that he gave in to self-pity, which he presented as his chief character flaw in his whole life. I don't know exactly how what he wrestled with the most. And I think what it was that he had had a resolve not to give in to the whatever wayward ways he had had before the White House, because the stakes were too great, and he knew that he was a target in that regard. And the flaw was that he felt sorry for himself. He thought he was doing a good job on across the board on peace, the economy, and ending the deficit, and doing things that the American people would want, but that the country was still on a tabloid obsession that didn't really care about that. And that's what made him feel sorry for himself and crack his resolve not to give in to those temptations. It was, I didn't know about it at the time. In fact, I didn't know about it until I wrote, but the Lewinsky affair was pretty furtive and you know, he broke it off for a year. So it was a terrible, tawdry, furtive thing compared with what many affairs are. But he said his resolve cracked in self-pity. That's basically, and he
I don't understand that, though. I don't understand that. I mean, help me out as somebody who knows him very well. You've known him.
Well, I've told you just about all I know on it. This is
but how does somebody's resolve crack because of self-pity? Like, what does that mean? Like, he felt so bad for himself because he was so pursued by
his resolve not to give in to whatever corporal temptations he had. Let's say he had lots of affairs. Now he has zero. And the resolve to do that in part is because the stakes are too high for his presidency. If he thinks that his presidency is being ignored anyway, and that people are pursuing him and saying that he killed his own best friend, and they're pursuing Filegate and Travelgate and Chinagate and all of these other things in obsession and ignoring what he's trying to do to the country, he cracked in the sense that the resolve that he had not to give in to those temptations, why the hell am I doing it if I'm not being appreciated anyway? And his resolve cracked in self-pity, that he's not being appreciated as a president. That's as clear as I can make it anyway.
No, that makes sense. That explaining it like that makes sense. I appreciate mm-hmm. it. Well, let's get to some of the more substantive and policy-oriented and foreign affairs-oriented mm-hmm. sections of the book. You talked, there's a section where he's talking about I guess disbelief is almost a word for it, but you tell me what you think of how the leaders of India and Pakistan are willing in their standoff, and we have to remember back, it was more intense back then than it is now, 2009. But
and it's none too great now.
No, and it's right, exactly. It's not peaches and cream
right.
now.
It was very intense.
It was very intense back then with Pakistan and India regularly launching missiles and nuclear tests. And he just can't wrap his head around the fact that the leaders are threatening, and he has decent relationships with both, the leaders are threatening to kill millions of people in the other country.
Yeah, he said he described the Indians saying that they had a far larger population by about 600 million people than the Pakistanis, so that an all-out nuclear war would leave India with probably 300 or 400 million people to start over, and whereas Pakistan would be annihilated, and therefore it would be a victory. And he said against that, the Pakistanis would say, "Oh no, India is a vast plain, and it's got a lot of people, and the nuclear poisons and gases would filter over that and kill all of the Indians on the plain, whereas mountainous Pakistan had plenty of places for people to hide in caves and survive." And he expressed wonder and said, they really talk like that. They really talk like they could actually survive and win a nuclear catastrophe like that that would poison the whole planet. And this was fights between over Kashmir, which is a majority Muslim population, but it is administered by India, and they've been quarreling about that over since. And it was a flashpoint for terrorism. Bin Laden had people in there fighting for the Muslims to get rid of, because they felt the same way about Hindus as non-believers as they do about Westerners. So it was a flashpoint not only for nuclear war but for terrorism, and it became a running theme in the book. I mean, when Clinton went to Pakistan in the year 2000, he told me, at any rate, that there were active plots by bin Laden to have him killed, that they tried to intercept some people with shoulder-fired missiles and missed them. that there were plots in Bangladesh as well, and that it was serious enough that none of the security agencies wanted him to go, and that they actually landed in Pakistan in a dummy Air Force One without him in it. That he landed in a different unmarked plane, kind of skulking in there. So this was pretty serious stuff, and kind of a running theme toward the end about terrorism.
Now, he also, and some other news, I mean, that's just, it speaks for itself, that section. I mean, just the disbelief he had. Some other international news came when the leader of Russia in 1995, Boris Yeltsin, comes to Washington, D.C., and nearly creates an international incident, although it escapes media attention. Tell us about that.
Well, Yeltsin, on two successive nights when he was a guest in 1995 in Blair House, tried to escape Blair House totally.
Blair House, we should point out, is right across the street from
the White House.
At the time, that street was open. It's not anymore, but at the time, there were cars and cabs that could drive by. Sorry,
right.
Go on.
And he came out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the president was waked up because the Secret Service discovered Yeltsin out in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, two sheets to the wind, drunk, in his boxer shorts, trying to hail a cab to go get a pizza. It was a profound, big embarrassment. And the next night, he said, was even worse, although not as spectacular, that Yeltsin tried to sneak out again, drunk, down the back stairs, didn't get out of the building, but was accosted by Executive Protective Service agents, and then Russian agents came running up behind him, and the agents didn't recognize Yeltsin and confronted one another. He said, we could have had a terrible incident then. But all of this is in the context of him talking about that Boris Yeltsin was more than just the jolly Russian drunk that his image had, that he was a severe alcoholic facing perhaps the most daunting political challenge of any world leader that Clinton said he knew, how to rebuild or to build free institutions in the ashes of the old Soviet Empire, threatened by the mafia and hardline communist or military people who wanted to restore the Russian Empire, who are still there all around Putin. He said in across 11 time zones that to try to create democracy in the former Soviet Union was as big a challenge as he could imagine, and he was trying to help Yeltsin do it, and he said he's a formal and very severe alcoholic. And this is the kind of trial that we have to wrestle with in secret, because naturally he wanted to conceal all of his impairments.
The what was the biggest surprise when you sat down and you started writing this? What was the most revealing moment? Actually, before I ask you that question, there's one thing I wanted to ask you, which is there is not a lot of, even though Bill Clinton says one of his biggest regrets as president is Rwanda and his failure to successfully prevent the genocide there. There's not a lot of reference to Rwanda in this book.
No, I think that is in retrospect, and he does say that in retrospect. But at the time, he said, "Look, in the real world," he said a couple of things. He said, "It's not very practical to think that the world is going to respond in the blink of an eye. That there were 750,000 people killed in 100 days, mostly without guns, with machetes." That's too quick. And he said it was not on CNN, and it took 2 years to mobilize an effort to do something about Bosnia. You're not going to do anything in 100 days. We should have done it, but it would have taken lightning attention, and there would be no way that you could do it other than as a unilateral operation, which would have been politically unpopular. So I think part what he said on the record was that we may not have been paying enough attention, but even if we had paid a lot more attention, the notion that the world would have mobilized in time to do anything about that is a pipe dream. He did say, though, that it was on the world's conscience, and he went there and met with victims, and there was a very poignant scene in Kosovo, even when he talked about meeting with Rwandan families that had been hacked to death. And the lesson that he took out of that was that fighting ethnic hatred, whether it's in Ireland or Bosnia or Kosovo or the Middle East, is the world's biggest problem as the world gets smaller. as the globe gets smaller, and that we
you know, but he did so much. He did so much good to in terms of Ireland, peace in Ireland, peace in Kosovo. Why not Rwanda? Why did he? I mean, Bosnia was not popular when he, you know, when he ordered NATO intervention or when he mobilized NATO intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Why not Rwanda? And I understand that you're saying that, like, in retrospect, he feels bad, but it doesn't seem like. From reading this book and from what you're saying, it seems to me like you're saying, like, it never even was a thought to him. He never thought he could do it.
Well, I don't think that he did. And I think that by the time people paid any attention to it, everybody was already dead. He also said Rwanda was not on CNN. So we care about it now, but we care about it in retrospect. We didn't care about it at the time until it gradually dawned on people that this was a major genocide. But 100 days is a blink of an eye in something like this taking place in Central Africa. And if it's not on CNN, a lot of people didn't know about it. Now, they knew about it in the government, but it sounded to me as though he was saying that there were no practical proposals put forward to intervene in this, and it would have taken a lightning response that we may wish we would have done, but at the time, nobody took it seriously. And maybe he's apologizing about that, because you're right, he did say that it was a great regret not to have done it. But in the book, and at the time when we talked about it, he said it was not on CNN, and to kill that many people by primitive means without great power interventions in the middle of in an isolated place like that, it was just not practical. Who was going to intervene? We would have had to do it in lightning and unilaterally. And it would have had to be a military intervention. And things like that just don't happen as quickly as they would have had to happen.
Hmm. Just a couple more questions. I know you have a busy schedule. Another big momentous scene in the book occurs between the former president and his vice president, Al Gore, who holds him responsible. Gore holds Clinton responsible for his losing, for tainting the legacy of the Clinton-Gore years with his personal failings. And Bill Clinton, thinking that Gore failed because he didn't send him into states, Gore did not send Clinton into states where perhaps he could have helped him win, such as Arkansas, and a state that he lost and certainly would have made up
New Hampshire.
And various states that where maybe he could have helped, where Bill Clinton was, you know, possibly more popular, although those are certainly those things are in dispute. I recall being on the campaign trail in 2000. Reporters would talk about talking to voters, and they would sneer, they would turn their nose up at Al Gore because of Clinton, and yet in the same breath, you'd ask them if they could vote for Bill Clinton for a third term, would they? And they would say yes. It was one of the weirdest things I'd seen. But in any case, that was a very, very intense two-hour conversation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and of course, this is something that I didn't have on my list of questions, because sometimes he would just say, I want to put this on the record, and you don't know about it because it wasn't on the record, but Al Gore came in here the other day, and we had a two-hour Donnybrook over the who was responsible for the loss to George W. Bush in the 2000 election, and he wanted to get it down, and he went back and forth, and there were a half a dozen arguments on either side, and typically he recounted Gore's attacks on him almost in balance with his responses to Gore. It seemed to have developed momentum and gotten warmer as it went along, meaning more heated. Gore even said that, quite apart from the politics, that he was upset that Clinton didn't apologize to him personally for the lapse into the Lewinsky affair, and Clinton came back at him saying, "You're a captive of Washington's cynical filter on this thing. I failed. I said everything I could say to everybody, and you needed to separate the politics from the personal and trust the voters to be able to separate you from me." And Clinton wound up saying, Al, Hillary has a hell of a lot more reason to resent me over Monica Lewinsky than you do, and she ran in New York unabashedly on our political record and trusted the voters to be able to separate the personal from the political, and that's what you should have done. You'd be president. So, yeah, it was quite heated, and it went back and forth with each of them giving as good as they got. Of course, that's only one episode of dozens in the book. There are lots of times that it's more funny and certainly more collegial between Clinton and Gore.
Gore last question.
Has a sense of humor, I thought.
Yeah. The last question I have has to do with just more of a journalistic slash historian question. Not to get too much in the weeds, but you roomed with Clinton in 72 in Texas during the McGovern campaign, I believe.
Right.
And then you didn't really know him for very long. You didn't really know him in the intervening years, but then when he became president, you went to him and kind of proposed yourself as an Arthur Schlesinger-like historian.
No, that's wrong.
No, that's not true? Okay.
No, he's
correct the record then. I've seen that in media accounts. Tell me, how did you broach this with the former president?
I didn't broach it. He sought me out. He sent for me. I didn't see him for 20 years. And when he was president-elect, he asked if I could come see him at a dinner, and in a one-minute conversation, he said he was very concerned about history, and he'd like the footnotes in my Martin Luther King Parting the Waters book from presidential libraries, and that he was concerned about preserving a more accurate, living, breathing record than he was afraid was going to be preserved. So this was his initiative and his idea right from the beginning. I was astonished. I had no thought of it. I was completely absorbed in my own work on writing about the 1960s. So it was his idea. It was his initiative.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, what did you did have a concern about being seen as too close to him as a subject, or you did not, or explain how you tried to figure that out? Obviously, you're very, you know, eminently respected historian. You won a Pulitzer Prize for your work on the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. Obviously, it's different covering, or not covering is not the right word, but being a historian for someone contemporaneously, someone who's still alive versus somebody who has long been dead. Did you worry about being too close to him? How did you negotiate that? And what's the difference between writing about a historical figure who can call you up and yell at you versus somebody who can't?
It's a huge difference. I mean, one of his ideas, having broached this to me, was that I move into the White House and become his Arthur Schlesinger, which is probably where you saw that news story. And I told him not that I wouldn't recommend that, that it wouldn't be objective. I couldn't pose as being an objective person if I moved into the White House, and that in a way it even tainted Arthur Schlesinger to some degree. And so I didn't recommend that he have anybody do that, and I certainly wouldn't do it. I said, you've got to make the best history you can, keep the best records, and leave the historical assessment to someone else. And in that vein, I don't consider this a historical assessment the way my others were on Martin Luther King. I don't present it that way. This is a memoir of gathering a primary record and what it's like to be sitting in the White House with an active president doing this recording. It's a glimpse rather than being filtered through the media or filtered through our ideas about Clinton, this is filtered only through my record of it. I'm trying to give an objective thing of what he said. And as a matter of craft, it's very difficult because it's like a two-person play where one is me, and I don't normally write about myself, and the other is the President of the United States. So I use myself only for a point of reference and a little bit of relief there, but I don't call this a history. This is a glimpse at a primary record and what it's like to gather it.
The book has gotten a lot of really excellent reviews, but Evan Thomas, the editor of Newsweek, writing in The Washington Post, suggests that he wished you had been tougher on Clinton, that you should have, you know, making a pun from the subtitle of your book, Wrestling History with the President, you should have wrestled with Clinton more forcefully. Do you think there's anything to that?
No.
Okay, explain. Why? I mean, like I said, most of the reviews have been great, but asking you about, well, so-and-so says you're an excellent author and the book is really amazing isn't likely to provoke an interesting response. But the issue of, I can ask you that if you want me to.
No, Evan wanted more Lewinsky. But that's because he was saturated with, and that's all he can think of when he thinks about Clinton. There's been plenty of Lewinsky. The last thing the world needed was somebody to wrestle with president about, you know, thong underwear or anything. My role, and I was wrestling too, my role was to try to get as much primary material about what a president thinks about and how being a human being, in the most personal branch of our governments, you know, the executive is the only one where all the power is vested in one person, therefore it's personal.
Right.
How does he see all of these issues, including his own personal life to some degree and his family life, coming together in the crucible of the White House? And I was trying to get him, my main thought was, what are people going to think about when they study this 50 years from now? Can I get the most, the best stuff there? To some degree, it depended on rapport. I did worry and confessed worrying that if I contradicted him or gave him the wrong advice when he asked, what do I do when he asks me for advice? Do I say I'm just here to ask questions and get a record, and at the risk of his losing interest and stopping asking me to come do this? So, yeah, maybe I should have been tougher on some issues, but if I were, it wouldn't have been on Monica Lewinsky. It would have been on more substantive issues.
In fact, you said that maybe I misread this when you said it, but you said Bill Clinton suggested that when you go back and revise the book, you might want to toughen some sections up as well. Did he mean that same type of thing? Don't get me wrong, I did not view this book in the same way Evan Thomas did, but I'm just wondering. It's very difficult when you're writing about somebody who has given you such access, and your point is to kind of try to help people understand how this guy saw the world and saw his presidency.
Right.
You know, you're not writing a New York Times front page story, about, you know, that when what you're trying to just like, you know, and then Bob Dole's version is blah, blah, blah. That's not your goal. You're trying to present his point of view. But is that what he meant when he said
I think what he meant was that he was evaluating this book by the standards of what a journalist would do if a journalist had him on the record, say, on Meet the Press, and that you're supposed to be tough on whatever issue you think is most of importance for the moment. And I agree with that. I think that's what you're supposed to do, but this was not journalism in that respect. These things were going to be secret. I was trying to imagine historians looking at them 10, 15 years from now, and my goal is to stimulate the flow of revelation of Clinton when he sounds like he's being real. And of course, it's not that easy to know. How do I know? When he's actually saying something that is really new and revelatory. And my dilemmas were constantly, if he veers off from a discussion of ordering airstrikes in Bosnia to an account of birdieing a hole with Greg Norman on a golf course, do I interrupt him and say, don't do that, and try to get him back on some policy matter, or do I think that historians in the future will find it very interesting how he got from one to the other and then from the golf to something else? So generally speaking, it was pretty, I was just trying to make it, I was trying to do whatever I could to give it the feel of honest, authentic revelation and to keep it going and not interpose my own judgments about what the significant news was that I needed to wrestle to the mat, because that's not what this was. This was a private, you know, collection for the future.
Yeah, an unbelievable opportunity for you. The last thing is you and Bill Clinton had talked years before about electoral politics, and in your view, the limits of going into electoral politics. I don't know how old you were in 1972, but obviously you were
both
slightly
25.
Okay, you're somewhat disillusioned with the country in 1972 and the result of the election in 1972. And he said to you, and this is one of the last quotes in the book, if you want to solve the world's big problems, you have to start with fights over who rides first in the motorcade. What does that mean to you, and do you think he's right?
Yes, when he said that, he remembered telling me that in 72. I was so disillusioned by politics, I said, I'm going into writing where I think there's more integrity in the written word. And in the White House after these 8 years, I told him, reminded him of that. And he said, yes, I told you that because I said it was so petty down there that we were refereeing these petty disputes in the midst of the Vietnam War. And he said, if you want to solve big problems, even like the Vietnam War, you've got to build up your tolerance for fights over petty things like who sits where in the motorcade. You got to go through human nature instead of around it, like by implication he was saying writers do. They just make up words and, you know, make up moral stances without constraint from the real world. At the time when he said that in 72, I thought he was just an automatic pilot politician. When he reminded me of it, it was in a different context where I said, you know, that in a way I was ashamed for my own profession because I found him up close much more idealistic than a lot of my friends in the media who were writing about him, who were quite cynical. And so it was strange because I was saying, gosh, maybe I should have sucked it up and stuck with politics. And he laughed at times and said, well, sometimes I wish I had written, you know, about Martin Luther King instead of being in politics. But I didn't believe him. He loves politics. He loves history maybe almost as much. But he did strike me. The most striking thing about him, observing him up close, was that there was an idealistic strain that survived everything, including a lot of disparagement in the public culture.
I think you probably both picked right.
Yeah, I hope so.
Just based on achievement alone.
Yeah, but it was an amazing experience to be doing that, and sometimes I did feel like I was on a different planet, and I didn't know whether it was because, you know, for 29 days every month I was back in 1965 in Selma or somewhere with Dr. King, and then I'd go down to the White House and be just amazed by what went on, or what. But it was an amazing perch to record things inside the residence in the White House.
Well, it's a great read, and thank you so much for joining us. This is Taylor Branch, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. It is for sale by Simon & Schuster. You won't have any tough time finding it in any bookstore or on Amazon.com. Taylor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jake. I enjoyed it.
That's all the time we have on the Political Punch podcast. Our thanks to Taylor Branch for joining us for this extensive conversation. Also to our producer, Huma Khan. As always, I'm Jake Tapper in Washington, D.C. Thank you for downloading us.